They're not your prescription? John told himself that nobody stole someone else's glasses. In this situation, he did not wish to serve as waiter, his normal spousely role when his wife did the cooking, but somebody had to do it, and he would not suffer Richie's volunteering. But when he stood up, bowl in hand, Richie said, reaching,
"If you're not going to eat that..."
John let him exchange it for the empty bowl. Why not? Joni entered with a napkin-covered platter and a narrow dish containing a hard new stick of butter as opposed to the easy-spread tub margarine that was routine. He had not known Annie was in the house. This must have been frozen. Richie chided her affectionately.
"Hot rolls? Joni, you shouldn't have."
She lowered the dish and looked from John to the empty bowl before him.
"Aren't you the hungry one? But you can't have seconds. You have to leave room for what's coming."
She was talking to him as if he were one of the children. At the same time, he was touched to realize that however valid her other reason for giving herself no soup, the fact was that the two servings would have exhausted the only can, which meant that their criminal guest had got every drop of it. Richie nibbled daintily at a roll until Joan returned to the kitchen, at which point he devoured the rest of it in one bite and reached for another, while attacking the butter, which was still so hard that it tended to fragment against the dull blade, he said,
"I'm starved. I had quite a day."
"I know. I was there," John said softly, though he had a feeling that Joni would not have heard him had he shouted. "Sharon and Tim and I were just telling the police about it." Richie helped himself to more white wine.
"This is better food than I've tasted for a long time. They feed you like a dog at Barnes."
He gulped the remainder of the soup and packed it down with a third roll. He groaned in pleasure while reaching for a fourth.
"Be around here for long and I'd be as heavy as you, John."
"But you won't be here after this meal," said John.
"Almost forgot these."
It was Joni bringing the wooden-handled steak knives.
"You might want to sharpen them, John. They are pretty dull by now."
"Joni," Richie said, "I can't keep my hands off these rolls."
She looked genuinely pleased, but in point of fact, Joan did not like to cook and ordinarily resented any special notice paid to a meal of her making, with the idea that she was thereby being identified as no more than a housewife. It was therefore a kind of remonstrance when John said, "We had the children before Joan could go on for her master's, but she wants to go back to school as soon as the baby is a little older." She made no acknowledgment.
"Would you mind, John, bringing out the vegetables? I have to concentrate on the steak now."
He found the bowl full of peas and carrots on the counter next to the microwave, the bell of which rang as he approached. He opened the door and withdrew the hot potato puffs, but Joni, returning, stopped him from carrying them out in the plastic container. She had a dish ready.
"Did you sharpen the steak knives?"
"How could I?" he asked sharply. "You just mentioned it and then said get the vegetables."
"Is everything okay with you?"
She peered narrowly at him. His response was bluff.
"Well, sure."
"It just seems like you ought to be in a better mood."
"I am in a good mood," said he. "I've just had a long day."
"You've had kind of a nutty day, if you ask me."
She said it with obvious affection, a hand at the small of his back.
"You leave without saying goodbye. And those crazy phone calls, what were they all about? I didn't even understand the last one. I guess you were joking?"
"Sorry about trying to clown around," John said. "I realize I don't have much talent in that direction. It was just..."
She pushed him toward the doorway.
"Get that stuff out there before it's cold, will you please?"
In the dining room, Richie asked,
"So, you're not the boss in the family?"
John picked up a steak knife and tested its edge with the ball of his thumb. The dumb way, he was aware, and occasionally he cut himself, yet he continued to do it. Richie took notice of what he was doing.
"Here's the only test."
He pressed his own knife against the tablecloth and cut a long slit in it. In the next instant, John realized that Richie had used the back of the blade and done no damage to the cloth, but while watching the episode, he had convulsively cut his own thumb, and it was bleeding. Still smirking over his trick, Richie, it could be hoped, had not yet seen the wound. John turned quickly and returned to the kitchen, where Joni was just sliding the steak on the foil-covered pan into the broiler compartment at the bottom of the stove.
"Just cut myself," he said self-pityingly to her bent back. "The knives are plenty sharp."
"There's band-aids in the drawer. I'll get one for you."
John did not need her nursing. He knew exactly where the tin was kept. They had several each on hand at another place in the house where Melanie might suffer some slight damage in daily misadventures, and got one of the slenderer of the selection of bandages offered. Meanwhile, the profusion of blood from the slit in his thumb was, as always, remarkable. He saw his spotted trail on the floor. After cleaning the wound with a dampened paper towel, he went along crouching to wipe the vinyl tiles. When he returned to the dining room, the white wine bottle was empty, and only one potato puff remained on the serving plate. The peas and carrots, however, looked untouched. Richie put both hands flat on the table and drummed them for a moment.
"It might not be my place to ask this, John, but what are you doing in this line of work anyway? You haven't been making much money at it. Besides, it's mostly a woman's game nowadays, isn't it?"
Only by exerting the maximum in self-control did John manage not to blow up at the question which had already been asked, though perhaps not so candidly, by some of his in-laws and, of course, by his own father not long before the man died. Richie went on.
"It's just that you could do so much better."
John could not help it. "At crime? Killing people? Hurting people? Taking their property?
You could do a lot of good in the world and make a buck, too, so far as that goes."
"You're a born healer, John. You've done more for me in a couple of hours than all the quacks in all the years."
John could not have explained to himself why he made a sincere response. "My father wanted me to be a doctor. He never had the least idea of what my aptitudes were, if any. Just to be a doctor, because that's impressive as well as profitable. Don't be what he was, working in the same office of the same company all your life. Well, the latter was easy enough to manage, but to be a doctor you have to begin with pre-med. I couldn't even get past the basic chemistry course." Richie frowned.
"I'm talking about an inner thing, not the lies they teach in medical school. You'd be wasting your time taking courses."
The comment served to remind John once again that it was surely a waste to speak sincerely about anything with a madman. He could now smell the meat under the broiler. It was nauseating. Richie went on, leaning over his empty plate.
"You serve the truth."
Against his better judgment, John said,
"Then why don't you listen to me? Give yourself up."
Richie seemed to be thinking this over. After a moment, however, he said,
"One thing is certain. It's a waste of time for all concerned when I'm in Barnes.
But when you're there, people don't get hurt."
The corners of Richie's thin mouth rose, but whether or not it was in good humor, John could not have said.
"I wouldn't put it that way."
"For God's sake, you killed somebody there?"
"I had some trouble once,"
Richie said, staring at John.
"It was self-defense."
"Yet they released you?"
Richie threw up his hands.
"It was their idea, not mine. I have a very low opinion of them, if you want to know."
"The doctors?"
"If you think about it," said Richie, "we're all human. Where do some people get off setting themselves up as better?"
"Yeah," said John. Joni came in with the steak, which at another time would have been John's idea of a spectacular feed. It came from Uncle Phil's private source of aged beef, but now was seen as disgustingly big and thick and oozing with pinkish fluid. It lay on a platter which she held at a distance from her body, for she had divested herself of the apron.
"Golly,"
Richie said as she deposited the dish on a silver trivet between him and John. John could not bring himself to go find the proper carving knife. Before Joan could object, he sawed off a hunk of meat with his steak knife, which, though it had been sufficiently sharp to slice the skin of his thumb, was dull at this job, and dropped it on Richie's plate. Joan brought the candlesticks from the sideboard, found matches in a drawer, and lighted both candles, which were virgin. Had they dined alone, she would have switched off the overhead fixture, a modest four-branched chandelier, but fortunately did not do so now. She sat down at the other end of the table, facing John. Richie was on his right and her left. John wondered what she would say when she saw that only one potato puff remained, or that his plate was as clean as when it had been put down, his glass empty. But if she noticed any of these phenomena, she left it unmentioned. She reached for the bottle and gave herself some red wine. Richie had politely waited till this moment. He began to cut his meat into small squares. Joan lifted her glass.
"Okay," she said. "A toast to the sale. I want to hear all about it."
John raised his glass and drank air. "How much should I cut you?" he then asked, steak knife and fork hovering over the meat. Joni shrugged.
"It got so late by the time I heard from you, I had a snack when the kids ate. Then this excitement."
She pinched her fingers at him.
"Real thin."
Richie, meanwhile, was chewing each little cube by itself, making a quick, emphatic event of it. Joan looked from one to the other with a big smile. John's sight line to her, unless he leaned to the left, was narrow between the two candles. It was up to him to invent the story. "It's the Murchison place."
"I don't even think I know about that one," said she. "Has it been listed long?"
His knife had grown no sharper. It was impossible to cut a reasonably thin slice, so he stopped trying. He realized that Joni did not really want any steak. "A long, long time. Tess and Miriam had given up on it."
Joan waited for more, but not getting it, smiled at Richie. "I'm sure you've got your plans."
Maliciously, John said, "I imagine you heard all about his plans when you had coffee."
Joan looked fondly at Richie. "Fact is, I think I did most of the talking. We never did get around to his business. He's the rare man who's interested in what someone else says. A woman, no less."
So that was it. Richie as feminist. "He's in pharmaceuticals," John told her.
"I'm impressed," said Joan.
"Just the word to begin with."
Richie seemed to brood for a moment, but then laughed cheerily.
"You haven't mentioned your family," said Joan. "You know your way around children."
Richie took a while to answer.
"I used to be married, but she didn't want kids."
"Some people are like that. That's their right. Now, with us, it was a calculated decision to go ahead and have the family and postpone the rest."
Joan shrugged.
"Not that I don't sometimes regret it, but..."
Richie asked,
"What I wonder is why John doesn't go into some field where the income is more certain."
John was utterly taken by surprise, but if Joni was embarrassed by the rudeness of the comment, she did not show it.
"That's just lately, with the downturn. John's made good money and will again. He's a terrific salesman."
John was moved. He could not recall ever having heard her defend him in public before. When members of her family were snide, she avoided the issue, went to the bathroom or whatever.
"He's got tremendous potential he hasn't yet used," Richie said. He speared a cube of steak and masticated it rapidly, waving his fork. "I'm trying to get him to listen to some proposals of mine."
"Really?"
Joan smiled at her husband.
"The risks would be all mine, I assure you," Richie went on. "But I happen to see great possibilities."
Joan asked John,
"Do you want to tell me about it?"
John looked away.
I can put him in the way of something big, Joni, Richie said.
He put his fork down and swiveled his head, surveying the room.
Do you want to live here forever?
Once again, Joan showed no evidence she was offended.
I've been after John just lately to look for something farther out with more land between us and the neighbors, cleaner air.
She glanced at John.
Weren't you out in the country someplace today?
The phone was ringing. John went into the kitchen where he answered on the wall-hung instrument.
John? Lang again. There's reason to think Marinville checked into a Red Wing motel this afternoon just off the motorway at exit 11 using a driver's license and credit card name of Charles F. Brookheiser. Earlier in the day, right here in town, Brookheiser reported he was robbed by a perpetrator answering Marinville's description, got his car and wallet with everything in it. Motel's the nearest to where the Smithtown cruiser was abandoned.
Thanks, John said when Lang paused for a breath.
There's more. Short time later, a big fire broke out at the Red Wing, took hours to put out, and the motel was just about totaled. Management and the volunteer fire department out there suspect arson. A burned body was found in the room Marinville checked into. Desk clerk's the last person reported who saw him. They're getting dental records from Barnes Psychiatric.
It's him, all right, John said. But that's exactly what he would do.
Better hold off on the celebrations, though. Be on the safe side.
I know it's him. Anybody else get hurt?
Early in the day, and business wasn't too great, luckily. That part of the unit was empty except for a man next door who was out at the time, and not back yet. They will talk to him when he returns, but it looks good for our side.
You said he would just have been sent back to Barnes.
You got it absolutely,
Lang said. He's finished now, though, said John. I know that was him who got burned. You can call off the stakeout of my house.
We'll wait for the confirmation, but meanwhile it's a bad night for law enforcement so far. Felonies all over the place, all at once. If we get a call out your way like a routine thing, disturbing the peace or something, they might give it to that car, but it wouldn't take him out of the neighborhood.
Sure, said John. The situation would not change. If he had apprised Lang, it could only have led to a hostage arrangement, which did not exist at present, and an assault team would arrive sooner or later. What that would mean in terms of psychic damage, not to mention the possibility of physical harm to his babies and his wife, could be imagined. He still respected the police, even after the manhandling by the state troopers, but he had convinced himself that he must not look for their help in his extremity. By now he felt selfish about it. When he returned to the dining room, Joan excused herself and left the room, presumably heading for the lavatory. She seemed to be walking steadily. She had not drunk much wine. As soon as she was gone, John stared at Richie. Did you check into a motel after I left the car this afternoon? Richie removed the glasses and rubbed his closed eyelids.
I really don't know how people can wear these things all day. Though maybe it's different if you've got your own prescription. Ever wear glasses, John?
You took those from the man you killed at the motel, didn't you? You took his clothes and car and glasses.
Richie opened his eyes, which were now slightly pink from the rubbing.
Have you got one complaint about what I've been doing since I arrived at your house? I've been knocking myself out to do the right thing, but you won't give me any credit at all.
He shook his head and changed his tone from the purely plaintive. You just remember that if you just realize nobody could have tried harder. Is that a threat of some kind, you dirty bastard? You ought to know me better than that, Richie said loftily. I'm just concerned about you and yours if the cops throw the lead around. I don't want you to blame me, because, frankly, I think you have a tendency to do that. You understand? I like and admire you a whole lot, but I can't ignore your tendency to evade personal responsibility for your problems. You don't use anything like your real potential. That's the fault of the economy.
It's Joni's fault you got married so young and have kids to support, so you can't afford a better way of life.
Richie showed his wry expression. Sorry, John, but I finally had to give you a dose of your own medicine. Show you what it feels like to be criticized by your best friend.
Which I am not, said John. You're my worst enemy. I would like to know you were removed from the earth.
In saying this, he realized he had lost control, but he got satisfaction in so doing. He was an amateur at murderous emotion. Just expressing it seemed to put him at an advantage, even though he was rationally aware that it would probably be considered a weakness by professionals in the field, among whom Richie was surely preeminent. Richie was not offended.
That's just an idea of yours, John. It might sound good at the moment, but it doesn't really mean anything, because obviously you can't press a button and make me disappear. And what you certainly don't mean is murdering me in cold blood. Even if you had a motive, and how would you get one? I've always been nice to you and yours, and that's all you care about in all the world.
Could he be right? But now Joni was back.
How are the kids?
Richie asked. Out cold. It had not occurred to John that that was what she had been doing during her absence. Now he found her choice of words disquieting.
They're okay?
She sighed. Why wouldn't they be? They drove me nuts all day. But they had a great time. Then Randy came and spoiled them rottener.
Did I tell you he wanted to give Melanie $100 bill?
Joan chided Richie.
I mean, really?
Such great kids,
Richie said, simpering at her.
Hey,
Joan jokingly proposed. You wouldn't be interested in including them in the home deal.
Take them for free. Have an instant house full.
She mooed.
That's the way I feel after a day like this one.
John said anxiously, It's the same every day. You've got one coming. I'll make it up to you. I'll stay home tomorrow.
That reminds me,
Joan said.
Tess called a couple of hours ago and said something about vouching for you with the police? What was that all about?
I don't know. Parking ticket, maybe.
She smiled at Richie.
Excuse the personal stuff. Do you drink regular coffee?
John seized the salad bowl and went to the kitchen, where anxiety kept him moving purposelessly about until Joan appeared with more dishes, stacked neatly atop the steak platter.
I'll just get the dessert,
Joan said.
Dessert?
Of course. What's wrong with you? Why are you so nervous? You didn't even eat much.
I didn't eat anything.
Aren't you feeling well?
But she had turned to the refrigerator before giving him a chance to answer. He lowered his voice and spoke to the back of her head.
It's him. He's...
She turned around and said indulgently,
A little drunk, I know. I guess that's permissible among friends.
She was about to revolve again, but John restrained her with a hand to her wrist.
He's not what he seems.
Is that some song?
I'm serious, Joan. I wish you wouldn't encourage him to stay. I'll explain later.
The request irritated her.
Look, I'm the one who has been stuck at home all day. I can use the company, believe me.
He's not drunk, said John. He's crazy.
I've been talking to the man for hours now,
Joan said.
There's nothing wrong with him. He wants to help us. Is that crazy? Are you drunk?
She peered closely at him for an instant.
Don't tell me you're jealous. Is that it? You think something was going on while we were here alone?
She was enjoying this.
No,
John said humorlessly.
Of course not. Please, Joni, I'm not kidding. He's dangerous.
He had not wanted to go that far, but she was laughing at him.
This is another of these jokes you've started to pull today, right? That's what a sale does.
She spun around gleefully and opened the freezer compartment.
Enough ice cream left. Oh, what I forgot to do, though, was take it out earlier so it could soften some. Will you get those glass dishes for me?
She was acting as if he had not said a word. Incredulous, he asked,
Do you think I'd just say something like that and let it go?
Joan gestured with the gallon container of strawberry ice cream, which neither of them much liked, but Melanie would eat no other flavor.
Don't ask me to explain your recent behavior. It's all new to me, but if it continues to sell houses, I'm not criticizing.
John was about to speak when Richie appeared with all the rest of the dinner dishes, including that bearing the untouched peas and carrots. He deposited them on the nearest clear portion of the counter.
Can I take something out? Now, Randy,
Joan amiably reproached him,
you go and sit down and let yourself be served.
Richie looked around, beaming.
I love a kitchen. It's the heart of any home.
John found the glass dishes in a seldom opened section of the cabinets and delivered them to Joan. Then, using his wider body, he in effect forced Richie to leave the kitchen without actually touching him or speaking. Back in the dining room, he told him quietly,
I want you out of here right after dessert.
He was surprised by Richie's quick and submissive agreement.
All right.
John decided not to press the advantage and ask whether the man really meant it. That would be a symptom of weakness, and he was suddenly strong. He had defended his home, employing only moral weapons. He had been sorely tried all day, but he had met the test. He sat down and briefly closed his eyes. Richie said,
You haven't even seen the children since you got home. You keep asking about them, but you don't go in and even look at them.
The triumph was short-lived. It was preposterous that a man like this could put John on the defensive.
God damn you, he said. I have to get rid of you first, don't I?
Richie lowered his eyes.
You hate me more than you love them? That's unworthy of you, John. It really is.
In the next moment, however, he was bright again, for Joan had carried in three little glass bowls of ice cream and a plateful of Melanie's favorite oatmeal raisin cookies.
Coffee in another couple of minutes, said she, and having served the men, she sat down at her end of the table.
Richie had been emitting murmurs of pleasure since his first sight of the ice cream, and when he identified it as strawberry, he said,
My favorite! How did you know?
I told you this is all potluck,
she smiled. But it wouldn't have been much different with longer notice.
John can tell you I'm not much of a cook. He's better. He cooks three or four times a week.
Richie's scowl came and went.
You do all right. Maybe you should be the one selling real estate.
And let John stay home with the little demons. I could handle that.
She included John in her throaty laugh.
Tell him whose idea it is that you stay home. John said, defensive again and despising himself for it.
Pretty much yours, isn't it?
She laughed again. The main reason I sell real estate is that I can be near home, John said. The alternative around here would be to commute to the city a 10-hour day.
If you make good money, you can afford good child care.
Richie said solemnly, incising designs with the edges of his spoon in the smoothed but as yet untasted ice cream. He made his voice markedly sympathetic in addressing Joan.
I say good because so many places can't be trusted nowadays.
Joan agreed with energetic chin movements.
But it's not a thing of just money. We had one in town here where the kids got food poisoning from the sour milk used for cocoa, and that place was the most expensive in this part of the state.
Too many of them are run by perverts,
Richie said, gesturing with his implement.
But then what isn't? That's certainly true in the city. I was hoping it might be different out here.
Not on your life,
Joan said cynically. But then she caught herself and asked John in a jokey way,
Oops, have you got Randy's check yet? He might want to change his mind.
He and I have concluded our deal, John said levelly. It's too late to change it now.
Richie chuckled at him but spoke to Joan.
He's quite the negotiator. He can talk the birds out of the trees.
I told you he was a good salesman.
They were both beaming at John, teaming up on him again. He missed Sharon terribly. She had been Richie's enemy from the start. He needed a partner with that sort of metal. He simply could not do single-handedly what must be done. He heard a distant cry. He reacted more quickly than Joan, whom he heard saying as he ran from the room, "Melanie's still the noisiest at night, not the baby." This was true. Melanie had frequent nighttime alarms, whereas little Phil was unusually placid for an infant once the lights were out. Melanie was scared of the dark, but could not sleep at all in the presence of the feeblest nightlight. Her father, himself an uncertain sleeper his life long, was the more sympathetic parent. Joni had once slept through an early morning seismic tremor that caused a bathroom tumbler to fall and break. Whatever the state of the nursery door, wide open, closed, or just ajar, Melanie soon enough demanded a change. At the moment it was 2 inches from full closure. John had to open it all the way so that enough light came in from the hall fixture to see by. His daughter was sitting up in bed. He hugged her narrow body with its fine groove of spine, her hair in his neck. This was as intimate as he had been with anybody all day, except for the repellent wrestling match with Richie. After a moment, he realized that though her eyes had been wide open, the child had probably been asleep from the first and was not aware of who he was. He lowered her head to the pillow and pulled up the blanket. Phil's crib was in the darkest corner where the angled door cut off most of the reflected light from the hall. John could hardly see him and so probed, very gently. A baby was there all right. He found a tiny hand and heard a faint sigh. If he turned on the light, someone might awaken. Besides, Joni had just returned from making her own bed check. The children were perfectly okay. All he had to do was get rid of Richie and everything everywhere in his world would come back to normal. Once Melanie was safely grown up, he could kid her about voluntarily climbing into a murderer's lap as a 3-year-old. But suddenly, he felt superfluous at the bedsides of his own children. He had an urge to flee from them, from Joni, from every responsibility. As he went into the living room, this perverted idea obsessed him so much that, to prove he was impervious to it, he quietly opened the door and slipped outside. The silver body of the car was conspicuous in the light of the street lamp. John could see nothing else. The car was unlocked, of course. Richie had no need for personal security. Were someone else to drive the vehicle away, he would lose only that which had never belonged to him and could simply steal another. If someone offended him, he killed the offender. His freedom of action was unconditional. John climbed into the driver's seat but did not yet close the door. He sat there looking at the building that his wife and kids currently shared with a homicidal maniac. But in fact they had done so with impunity for at least an hour before the master of the house came home. Richie was harmless when on those premises. To keep him there was to protect the rest of the world. Richie had left the key in the ignition. John turned it far enough to empower the preliminary electrical system. Numbers became visible on the digital dashboard clock, but not so far as to start the engine. He touched the knob of the gear selector, but it was a manual 5-speed system. He was licensed only for automatic. He did not properly know how to operate a real gear shift, could certainly not still remember his father's instruction when he was 14. You were supposed to do something with the left foot in the clutch. He could probably not have driven away had he wanted to. But then his only obligation was to look after his own family, and they were not in trouble. By means of a simulated thrust of pride, he rejected any feeling of relief as being unworthy of him. To be no hero was not shameful, but taking satisfaction in that state of affairs would be. Should he subsequently change his mind, he put the ignition key in his pocket before stepping out of the car and noiselessly pressing the door shut. When he reached the dining room, Joni said, "Everything okay? We thought you left town." This was jocular, but Richie asked, as if seriously, How's the weather out there? So despite John's care with all doors coming and going, he knew. Just took a breath of fresh air. It's a nice night. You driving back to the city?
Oh, Joan cried in dismay. If we just had a guest room, this little house.
John saw this as a personal attack. Weren't you the one who wanted this place originally?
I'm also the one who has wanted to move for at least a year.
Richie grew agitated.
Please, he said, raising his hands. It's an honest difference of opinion.
Well, not quite honest, Joan said. The idea, which I thought we agreed on, was that we were not supposed to stay here for the rest of our lives.
God, said John. It's only 3 years, more or less. You were pregnant with Melanie. Without thinking, he looked at Richie as if for confirmation, as one does when arguing in the presence of a third person, then remembered and suppressed his next point. Richie was scowling into the bowl of melted ice cream before him.
The idea was, Joan went on, we couldn't lose. Values were going up and up. You were the authority on real estate. Now it was Joan who sought Richie's moral support, smirking at him. He talked himself into it.
The slump is only now, John said. Only temporary. Everybody knows that. Property can only go up. That's a fact of human existence.
Richie violently shook his head.
This isn't right. You bet, said Joan.
Was she drunk on so little wine? John noticed that her glass was now empty. Anyway, John said, would this be the time to move with a baby?
That's an excuse anyway, said Joan. John happened to notice that Richie was trembling, but it seemed more important to address his own needs. Nothing could be more unfair than Joni's general implication, which she had never previously been so bold as to make, even in front of Renee, though perhaps she did it in private with that mean bitch who had always despised him. But this was far worse, even if she had no way of knowing what Richie was.
You're wrong, he said, and then he descended to pathos. I've done the best I could.
Richie slammed a fist against the table, just missing the glass bowl before him, but causing it to jump and lose silverware to clatter everywhere.
How can this be?
He avoided looking at either of them.
Good question,
Joan said wryly. John now belatedly realized that she had been mostly kidding, making her point, but not being angry about it, which in fact was often her style with him. He would not have been so touchy had he had another kind of day.
All right, he said, so I'll try harder.
She stood up, smoothing her dress at the hips, and said with vivacious irony,
I'm glad we got that settled. I'll go get the coffee.
She went to the kitchen.
Richie's teeth were clenched. This is not going to work, John. I've only been holding back because of my friendship with you, but it's not doing you any good. She's your enemy.
For an instant, preoccupied, John failed to understand the reference. Richie elucidated.
This wife of yours.
John leaped up and threw a fist at Richie's face. At the last moment, with his animal reflexes, Richie evaded the blow. John had swung with such force that, missing his target, he was thrown off balance and would have fallen had Richie not stabilized him with a quick hand.
It's only the truth, Richie said calmly. A guy like you could go anywhere and do anything. I know you better than you know yourself. You might think you want to be limited, but underneath it all, you can't accept it.
John stood there gasping for breath. He had said as much to himself from time to time, but considered it an exercise of the imagination and thus permissible, like modest sexual fantasies. For example, thinking of Renee when making love with Joni, but his attraction to Sharon was more a moral idea than a sexual urge and had to do with her standing up to Richie and, in a personal sense, defeating him, for she had escaped from his control. But then she only had herself to save.
You want the gun? Richie asked. You really ought to do it yourself.
I'll tell you why. You'd only blame me the first time something went wrong.
Then what? John asked. The chill of it had frozen his emotions, and he was able to proceed as if serene. Richie smiled.
I know things about freedom. They've been locking me up all my life.
You and I will go off together? Richie frowned.
I'm not queer, John. You can have all the girls you want. I've had every kind of sex myself, and I don't care much for any. I don't like anybody, man or woman, to get that kind of hold on me.
He spoke ever more rapidly, as if excited, though still at low volume, but Joni would be back at any moment. John had to arrive at some kind of resolution now. Time had finally run out.
And the children? Foster homes are another thing on which I'm an authority, Richie said. I wouldn't wish them on any kid. The thing nobody should ever be in this world is little and helpless. You're just asking for it.
You're telling me to, Richie interrupted.
Don't say that, John. I'm not telling you anything. You'd just get mad at me. You blow up at everything I say. I've learned my lesson.
He grinned warmly.
Yet here we are, still a team. We must have some connection.
John was now beyond anger, which had failed him all day. You're right. I'm thinking. But whether his thoughts were useful was another matter. Sharon said she owned a gun and prayed that Richie would show up at her place. Having seen her in action, John knew this sentiment was not bravado, but how in the world could he justify afflicting her again with Richie? Then there were the police, whom, of course, he could not bring to the house without disturbing Joan and the children. That had always been out of the question. But what about leaving in the car with Richie, insisting on serving as driver and driving to police headquarters? Would Richie sit there passively while he ran in and got Lang? It would have to be Lang, because explaining the situation to a new officer would not be simple. He now had had experience with cops, who were much more complex than he had supposed, no doubt necessarily so, for theirs was a world of Richie's and Sharon's drug-dealing husband, homicides and madmen, mutilators and molesters. The coffee was taking too long. John was suddenly worried about Joni's current well-being and, regardless of Richie, left the room. This must be fake guilt, since he was supposedly, for Richie's benefit, thinking of killing her. If that was fake, then the guilt had to be as well. Nevertheless, he felt awful. And when he reached the kitchen and saw her standing, intact, at the counter, fiddling with the coffee maker, it was as if some great menace had been removed. An irrational feeling, for Richie was still alive.
Is that thing acting up again?
She tossed her head.
What does function around here?
You. She turned around and said tenderly,
You do too.
I didn't mean that.
John wanted to embrace her, but could not permit himself to do so at this point. He might not find the strength to let go.
It's probably a loose connection. I'll take a look later. He can't stay for coffee anyway.
Randy? Really? Oh, too bad.
But her disappointment seemed tepid. Was she no longer enchanted by the man? Perhaps she was finally beginning to have her doubts. She went on to prove otherwise.
But we'll be seeing a lot more of him when he moves out here.
I guess we don't want to wear him out the first time. Before John could restrain her, she breezed out to the dining room where, when he reached them, she was urging Richie to call on her for any help he might need with his forthcoming move. Richie, meanwhile, was frowning ominously at John. John said quickly, I said you had to leave now. He turned to Joan. What I didn't say, though, was that I've got to go, too. I made a mess of the agreement to buy and don't have another form here at home. We're going to stop by the office. To which he kept a key for just such after-hour uses, which were common enough. The story was plausible. But Joni was not quite finished with their guest even yet.
Not that I'm going to play matchmaker, but if you'd like to meet somebody.
John, too, was dogged. Leave everything till I get back. I'll clean up. For the first time all day, Richie, and not he,
was the one off balance, asking, "Where are we going?"
"I told you," said John, "the office of Tesmere Realty. The bosses are surely gone by this hour, but if not, you must meet them. They are women, two nice women."
He led Richie to the door, Joan following. Before going out, John said only, "See you soon." There was not a moment to spare now, and nothing further to say that would not be distracting. Joan persisted. "If you're taking Randy's car, then he can stop in for a nightcap on the way back."
She was persisting, to the end, in being the perfect mate. Had Richie been a legitimate buyer of property, her performance would have been flawless. The pity was that John had never had such a desirable client as Richie seemed. He had never brought another home. There was a lack of moral balance in his profession. Clients might live all their lives in a house he had sold them and be succeeded by future generations of their own blood, but never see or even know where the agent lived or care. Why should they? They were not Richie's. Richie continued to be passive when they reached the car and John returned the ignition key to him, but once behind the wheel he asked,
"You mind telling me what this is all about?"
The interior of the car received some dim illumination from the little carriage lamp at the front door of the house, which Joni had helpfully switched on, and through the glass hatchback from the streetlight at the curb, but before John's eyes were habituated, Richie remained a silhouette.
"I had to have some excuse for getting out of there."
Richie was shaking his head.
"I'm sorry to have to say this, John, but you don't seem to have anything in order."
"That's true."
"You're boasting about it?"
"I'm admitting it." "That's different."
"Where's your pride, man?"
"Start the car," John said. "Let's get going."
Richie complied, reluctantly. As he backed out of the driveway, he said,
"You're leaving loose ends."
"You mean I should kill them all?"
John wondered at the ease with which he heard himself ask the question.
"It's not for me to say, is it?"
"Why are you so mealy-mouthed? If you're capable of doing something like that, and you are, why can't you talk about it?"
"Come on, John," Richie complained. "There isn't any connection."
Using only one wrist, he swung the car effortlessly around when it reached the street and headed in the direction opposite to that he had taken in the morning.
"There are things you do and things you say, and they're not the same. Everybody knows that. I'm surprised at you. I thought you were the one who always made sense."
"Not me," said John, and he was not being disingenuous. "I proved that today. You caught me off balance. I never knew what I was doing, and that's a nightmare for a guy like me. I'd rather die than go through that again. I lost all faith in myself for a while."
"And you blame me?"
Richie's question had little moral weight, but John responded as if it had.
"Blame may not be the right word. You might say you gave me an opportunity. What I did with it was up to me, in which case you deserve neither credit nor blame."
"I don't understand that at all," Richie said. "You seem to be bothering yourself about things that don't matter. I thought you really cared about your family and your home, but I guess you don't really. What you care about is yourself. How you feel at all times, whether you're living up to some idea of yourself, whether you're getting your own way. If that's really what kind of man you are, then you might not be any better than me. And I'm nothing."
Earlier on, John would have been devastated to hear this, but he was not at all disconcerted now.
"You're right, and you're also wrong. What you're right about is me. But maybe I can still make something of myself. You're wrong about yourself. It isn't true that you are nothing. You've brought great harm. You're no non-entity. You've proved you exist."
Richie whistled.
"Is that what you got me out here for, John? I could have told you that. We don't need to bring God
into it.
God? Who mentioned God? You know what I mean. When you talk that way, what you're really getting around to is religion, aren't you?
Do you believe in God?
Richie snorted.
I sure as hell didn't make myself. That's basic. You can take it from there.
You mean you can't be held responsible for what you do? This was not a question. Neither was it a matter of concern. They were approaching the streets of the DeForest Park area where the affluent lived. Probably the cop in the unmarked car had been called off the stakeout. There was no sign of him. That was all to the good. An explanation would have taken too long to make. No more time was available. Richie nodded at what he saw through the windshield.
Nice neighborhood. You bring me here to sell me one of these places?
Yeah, said John, relieved by a moment of irony. How about that one? He pointed at a stately white mansion to which the term colonial, much abused by realtors who used it for almost anything that could not be called contemporary, could legitimately be applied. As a professional, he knew who owned each of these houses, though when Tesmir sold a listing up here, one of the partners handled it and the six-figure commission. It had not taken John long to understand that if he was ever to make a big score, he must have his own agency. But that seemed less likely to happen as the months, and now years, went by. Yet neither was he ever prepared to take a job with a regular routine and a fixed salary. It had become almost enjoyable to tell himself he might be hopeless, like a man confessing he was too fat while smugly patting a pot belly. That had to change. Richie pulled the car in against the curb and stopped.
What's something like that go for?
They'd probably try to get $1.4 million, maybe five. That's 5 acres, and there's a 3-bedroom guest cottage in back. Big pool, of course. Gardens. Not exorbitant here, but in the present market, maybe it would go for $1 million, 2 million, or even less. But that's theoretical, of course. It's not for sale. That's J. William Osgood's house. He's CEO of
Think He's Home.
Reggie revved the engine and, before John could respond, added,
Now that's the kind of house you should have, John.
I'd settle for the commission on its sale.
Why should he have it and not you? Richie asked. All you need is some kind of break, and you'd get back your faith in yourself. I can see that. You're all ready, just waiting for the opportunity to show your stuff.
Sure, John said. You've got that right. Maybe I'll even win the lottery. Richie responded soberly.
Don't look for that to happen, because it won't. It's too impersonal. That's not your game.
John was suddenly nervous about sitting there at the curb. Not only did the municipal police furnish extra protection to the area, but the DeForest Park Association employed its own private security force. Anyone afoot on the pavement after dark or an unidentified parked car at any hour would soon encounter one patrol or another. Richie could be expected to fire without warning.
Let's get going.
Richie chuckled.
Let's go in there and nail him.
John had no emotion left for such matters, horrifying as they would have been at an earlier time. Do you think you can just walk in the door on somebody like that? Surveillance cameras, alarms, maybe a big dog, and the neighborhood even has its own private cops.
Hell, Richie said. We could try. All we need's an idea. I could cut my arm, see, and bloody up my shirt, ring the bell and ask them to call an ambulance, talking through the system, you know, not even trying to get inside, then sit down on the steps, bleeding. Laying down would be too much. You want to hold back some to be believed. You should even decline at first if they ask you to come in.
You'd have no time at all, John pointed out. Ambulances come right away out here. It's not like the city. This information embittered Richie further.
He's got the whole world where he wants it, but he doesn't impress me.
J.W. Osgood? Do you know him?
No, Richie said. But I'd like to meet him just once.
Why?
I hate him. I hate his name. I hate his house. I hate this street. Let's get out of here.
He kicked the accelerator, and they were jerked into motion.
Where now?
Good question. Someplace where no innocent strangers were likely to be afflicted, but that might mean another planet. Take a left there.
After a while, Richie said, We're leaving the good parts.
You can settle down now.
Richie laughed. I'm not worked up, John. You should see me when I'm upset.
Like this afternoon?
When?
You've already forgotten, haven't you? Do you remember my family?
Are you kidding? We just left them.
Richie cleared his throat.
Believe me, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but you could do better there, too.
Don't say any more about them.
You're right, Richie said. I apologize. I'm out of order.
They were approaching a main thoroughfare. Take a right here, said John, indicating the lesser street that came before. What about the doctors at Barnes? I can't believe they're incompetent.
John, you must understand what kind of person becomes a doctor. It's somebody who does so for one reason alone, to have power over people they say are sick.
He nodded solemnly.
And they've got the right to call anybody sick they want to, like cops can arrest anybody at all. Just think of it. What they say they want to do is help you, but who asked them? They force it on you.
They were now traveling along the secondary road, more or less parallel with the highway, but at a slightly lower elevation. It was a place of commercial garages and warehouses, now mostly dark. Here and there was a night security light, but street lamps were rare. John's vision was used to the dark by now, and in the illumination from the dashboard, Richie seemed as visible as if it were daytime.
Doesn't the medication do any good?
Ha!
Richie cried.
It makes you impotent. That's all it is supposed to do.
He squinted out the window.
Why are we driving along here? That's depressing.
You're a wanted man. You might be recognized out there on the main road.
Richie spoke tenderly. You're always looking out for me. You're the one person I know who doesn't try to get the hook in somebody. We're friends for life. I want you to know that.
Yeah, I do.
We argue sometimes, but brothers are like that.
That's right, John said. That's really more what we are than just friends, brothers. He was not being entirely hypocritical. By now, he and Richie did have a genuine connection. It could not be denied that they were close, like a jailer and his prisoner, though in this case it was difficult to say which was which. Who was the greater criminal to the other? Perhaps each played both parts simultaneously, which would indeed be brotherly. John was aware that he could never settle with the man without an act of fratricide.
I wouldn't have turned out this way if I had had a brother like you years ago,
Richie said.
You would have looked after me.
I would have kicked your ass, John said, not unkindly. Richie chortled.
Damn right you would have.
I'm an only child, John said. That's why I wanted another kid right after the first. He had just remembered that. Joan was right in saying that all we've done has been my idea, and she's always gone along, postponing a career of her own. She came from quite a big family. I don't have anybody. My dad died 4 years ago, and my mother married again and moved out west. That hit me hard. I was closer to her than to my father. I never really got along with him. She's never yet seen either of my children. John was saying these things for his own sake, so as to try to feel human for a moment.
You got no worries now, brother, Richie said. Your troubles are mine.
Neither one of us is alone against the world anymore.
That's fine, said John. But I'm the older brother, and I'll decide when I want you to help me. You get into too much trouble on your own. He put his hand out. I want your gun. I'll return it when there's good reason. They were still traveling along the road of warehouses, and the blacktop under them was suddenly full of potholes, the first of which gave the car such a jolt that Richie reduced the speed. He asked John,
Can you give me your word?
On what?
That I won't regret it.
John snorted. You like to do damage. You might see somebody you want to kill and regret not having the gun. Is that it?
Come on. You know what I mean.
I'm willing to promise I won't turn you over to the police. I can't see that it would make any sense for you to go back to Barnes, or, of course, to any prison. Richie laughed.
Amen, brother. I'm finished with all of that, but that's exactly why I have to keep the gun. You can understand.
Didn't I say I'd give it back when you really needed it to defend yourself? Richie stared through his window.
God, am I thirsty. Let's go over there and get a six-pack.
He was referring to a convenience store that could be seen, looking between a darkened commercial building and a parking lot full of school buses, out on the far side of the highway. It was all the brighter for being the only local source of illumination except for a self-service gas station, at the moment devoid of cars, an eighth of a mile to the west.
Okay, said John, but I'll be the one who goes in for the beer.
Richie whined.
I might see something else I want. I like to look around those places. You don't know what it is being cooped up for a couple of years, not able to buy snacks except from a machine, and you couldn't always get out to the lounge area. You might be under restraint of a hard brother.
He turned onto the next cross street, drove to the highway, and waited submissively at the traffic light there, even though it stayed red forever, and during this time there was but one vehicle— a battered pickup truck that passed on the main road. John himself would have been tempted, having determined that the coast was clear of police. Finally, to run the light, or anyway make a right turn on the red, illegal in city limits, and then a quick, sneaky, equally illegal U-turn, but he was suffering from an anxiety in which everything crawled in slow motion, whereas Richie seemed to have all the time in the world. Eventually, the light changed, and Richie drove across to the parking lot alongside the convenience store. Only two other cars were there. At least one must belong to whoever was working in the place at this hour. Such businesses were notoriously attractive to criminals, open as they were at all hours and often, as was true of this one, in an area that at night was remote from all humanity but those persons who might pause in transit to buy tomorrow's breakfast or a late-night snack. The clerks must worry about each new arrival. What a job. John instinctively viewed such matters from the perspective of an employee and not that of whoever made a profit from the franchise, still less the absentee licensing firm. He could too easily see himself behind the counter when some Richie entered. Richie was incapable of that sort of imagination. He answered only to his own urges. The initiative was always his. Everyone else in the world must wait for what he chose to do, and therefore, as long as he was alive, no one could be protected from him. Richie parked the car at a significant distance from the other two vehicles and, without shutting off the engine, opened his door. John reached over and turned the ignition key. The noise of the engine had not been loud, but the utter silence was startling. Richie stayed in his seat.
Why did you do that?
You're not going to make a quick getaway if that's what you had in mind.
I wasn't thinking of that, said Richie. I wasn't thinking at all.
That's what people do when they get out of a car, turn off the motor. John put out his hand. Let's have the gun.
John, I can't do it. I just can't. Don't ask me.
Then you sit tight.
I'll go in for the beer. John had formulated a new plan, the old one, to get the pistol away from Richie and kill him with it, having now been revealed as pitifully impracticable for a real estate man, father of two young children, husband to a woman who was his superior in moral strength. With Richie alone in the car, in an almost deserted parking lot at this hour, there could be no objection to an all-out assault by the police. He would ask the store clerk to call them, and, with him and whatever other customers were at hand, take refuge in a locked office or storeroom until they arrived. There was sure to be a gunfight in which Richie might well be slain. Of course, if he was not killed outright, he would be patched up and eventually sent back to Barnes Psychiatric. But it was the best plan John could devise. He was not a professional at this sort of thing, and he was all alone with the problem. "I can't stay out here," Richie said. "I'll go nuts. You come along, John. We ought to do things together. Then we can stick up for one another if anybody tries to give us crap." He left the car. John had no choice but to accompany him into the store. A husky black man in early middle age stood at the register, totting up the bill for several items assembled by a corpulent white fellow in his late 20s, packaged donuts and a carton of milk among them. The clerk glanced at the new arrivals, and John ritualistically nodded at him, looking quickly away lest his fear be visible. Richie loped swiftly to the rear of the store, where tiers of six-packs and ranks of stout plastic bottles could be seen through the glass doors of the refrigerated showcase. John stopped halfway along the aisle. All he could hope for was that they got out of there without incident. Apprising the clerk obviously could not be done in the time available, Richie came back with two packs of beer, one under each arm, so that both his hands remained free.
"Go get whatever else we need, John. Nuts, corn chips, or whatever."
John looked around as if seriously considering the request. The fat customer went out the door. The clerk asked in a strong enough voice to carry to them,
"Something you're looking for, gentlemen?"
"Chips," John said quickly.
"Next aisle, right side."
"Do we really need any?" John asked Richie. "I'm not hungry. Let's just hit the road."
"You're the boss,"
Richie said with verve, and strode past the clerk toward the door. John stopped at the counter as if to pay the tab, though of course he could not have done so, having no money on him. The clerk wore a short-sleeved blue shirt and a neat bow tie. With his heavy graying head and self-possessed expression, he looked as if he might be one of the retired cops who sometimes took such employment. John made the situation clear by calling to Richie,
"You got all the money.
Let's go,"
Richie said.
"No,"
said John, "we've got to pay." Richie put his back against the door and pushed it open with his rump.
"Hell with that. Did you see the prices these crooks are asking? They're highway robbers."
"Just bring the stuff back here," said the clerk in a voice of calm authority.
John had not been looking at him, but he did so now. The man brought a large handgun up from beneath the counter. Richie stopped where he was and produced an exaggerated grin.
"Well, if you're going to get nasty about it."
"That's right," the clerk said. "I am going to. It's happened once too often around here."
He included John in the gestures he made with the barrel of the weapon. Richie came back to the counter and carefully, working one side at a time, deposited the cartons of beer in front of the clerk. While the second six-pack, which had been under his left elbow, was descending to the counter, he swept his jacket back and from the right side of his waistband drew the revolver he had taken from Officer Swanson. He fired twice. The big man's body jerked as if from the blow of a fist when each of the slugs hit him. He lost the support of his knees and went down.
"There you are, John," said Richie. "You saw what happened. It wasn't me who drew first."
John felt himself shudder so violently that he could hardly maintain his balance, though perhaps that was only an illusion brought on by terror, for he quite competently went behind the counter and crouched to attend to the victim. The man was alive. He sat there as his shirt front turned red. Though struggling for breath, he managed to raise his bloodshot eyes and lift his gun to point at John. But he proved too weak to fire it. John had to exert very little force to take the weapon away.
It was an automatic. Ready to fire, he hoped, for he had never held one except in the form of a plastic childhood toy, and would not have known what to do other than simply pull the trigger. He came up behind the counter. He was conscious of the Band-Aid on his thumb and the wound under it, which was stinging and had probably started to bleed again. Richie smiled disarmingly, his own weapon at his side, muzzle pointing at the floor.
"Now you got yourself a gun, John. What in the world are you going to do with it?"
John never again looked at Richie's face. He continued to pull the trigger after the pistol was empty. The shots were still echoing across the aisles of shelved food. When he was finished, he tried to return the weapon to the fallen clerk whose property it was, but by now the man was unconscious, yet still alive. Without looking at Richie, John knew that he was dead. They had had a connection. He located the phone and called 911 for an ambulance. Then he dragged himself back to sit alongside the wounded clerk. Killing Richie in what was really cold blood had not yet horrified or sickened him, but he assumed that both reactions, and worse, might come when his sense of self returned. Perhaps he would not survive. But when he heard the approaching wail of the ambulance, he felt affirmative enough to climb to his feet and wait, standing up. This concludes the reading of Meeting Evil, a novel, by Thomas Berger. Copyright 1992 by Thomas Berger. This book was read by Bronson Pinchot. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Thomas Berger and was produced in 2011 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.